Yeah, she's
is it
that red line says.
Okay, now this is May 17, 2000, and this is the second tape for today.
Okay, I say that. Oh, did
I just said it?
Oh, okay, good.
Oh, you maybe better say it and keep it in the register.
Yeah, this is May 17th. Alfred Skonovich recording.
Second tape for today.
Yeah.
Say the year you got.
The year 2000.
Okay. Yeah. Good point.
I think that to get mixed up with avant-garde people is like a commitment to you know, what is radical, what is insecure, you know, where the only permanent structure is change, you see, in your lives. And it was part of the it was really an offspring of these people, and amongst them, I, you know, there was a certain glamour to being here illegally, you see. Mm-hmm. It was a plus for you. But then I remember when Franz Klein had his first show. He's now in his mid-50s.
Correction. Last week you said he was 47.
When 47, right. Okay. It was 50
it was
for the other guy.
50.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, right. No, it isn't correct. Okay. He's in his 40s. The other guy, de Kooning,
was,
yeah,
56.
50, yeah. It's hard to describe the success of when you feel an upswelling in the support of a painter. You know, it's not kind of universal. It doesn't affect the institutions in a country. You are immediately at odds with all of these people, you see. And to the people who are embattled, you are embraced, particularly in my situation. And you have allies, too, in the most unlikely places. I remember the first opening, the first one-man show for Franz Klein. And artists came there from all over the Western world. They arrived on tramp steamers, ships. They were in the country legally. They got here just to see this show. And many of them went back home. They were permitted to sleep in the gallery. There was a circular staircase that went up to the gallery, and a little three-man elevator.
What gallery was it?
This was Egan Poindexter.
Okay.
And no, it was Egan Gallery at that time.
Okay.
Then it became Poindexter,
right.
Egan. I don't know what month this, when Charlie got kicked out, that's right. People came to see these new works. How the hell did they hear about this in places like Copenhagen, you know, or Japan? But then I heard about it in London, you know, and they can do these things in painting. How can I describe it? To people, the downfall of the communist regimes that control the lives of hundreds of millions of people, to me, was signaled by defiant artists long before the war came down, almost a decade before this happened. They placed paintings in Gorky Park on a recreation ground, and they were all done in the style of Pollock and de Kooning and Franz Klein, you know. Because these were bitterly and obsessively attacked by, you see. Yes, go ahead.
A question.
Yeah.
You said this was before the war?
This incident with,
right,
the paintings in Gorky Park?
Yeah.
No, this occurred about 10 or 15 years ago.
And the
paintings, the secret police brought in tractors and ground them up into the mud, you see. I'm thinking of what President Kennedy said he awarded gold medals of freedom to de Kooning, Klein, and Mark Rothko. The investiture was conducted by Lyndon Baines Johnson because of the assassination of Fitzgerald Kennedy. But Kennedy said that as long as we are a free people, we shall admire their works. But the Russians were not a free people, and they put up our works, you see. Mm-hmm. And they could not crush the paintings, you see. They could not do that at all. Just as Andre Malraux tried to crush our movement, or Aldous Huxley with his, you know, it wasn't worthy of them, you know, to encourage the vandalism of our paintings, and so on and so forth. And it was unearthly. Mr. Malraux said something that, like a cliche. He said, well then, when an idea whose time has come, which I've heard before 1,000 times, this very unoriginal thing was said by this original man, you know, which meant that his job in the French cabinet was over, you know.
Andre Malraux said, an idea whose time has come?
Yeah.
Was he referring to
the American
modern,
the American boys, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so at some point he changed his mind, right?
He did, yeah. Uh-huh.
Or he changed jobs.
Well, the idea of Malraux, you know, I think of Voici des Silences, you know, the voices of silence, you know, these wonderful books about art. The man, we take Angkor Wat for granted. We see it in photographs. We see soldiers of different armies posing before it. But Angkor Wat was unknown until it was discovered from the air by Andre Malraux, who was flying around as he did during the Spanish Republican War. He was a fighter pilot. And he discerned these ruins. And
Angkor Wat? Isn't that around Thailand?
It is. It is in Thailand.
What was he doing there relating to the
It was
Spanish?
He was there in the course of his life. What was he doing there?
Well, you said he was not around the war.
Right. He was there when that neck of the woods was part of the empire, the colonies of France, including
Vietnam.
Indochina, right. And Vietnam, you see. Well, they were neighbored by the Dutch, but I don't know where.
Yeah.
But he observed these ruins. And yes, and he observed them. This would be in the mid-30s. And so we became aware of these structures. And yes, in 36, he fought in the Spanish Civil War. You know, within the same decade. Yeah. You know, a man with full of piss and vinegar, and was used as an attack dog.
And let himself be.
Yeah.
Only
Charles de Gaulle could pull a stunt like that. You know, tell a guy that you're doing this for
For God.
Viva la patria.
Right. So how did you hear about all this? I mean, how did you get your take on what was happening in France?
I lived in Paris. I met all sorts of people then, worked there. I was there when I finally got my green card and my British passport and went there. That would be in the
around 59 or 60.
Yeah.
This was long after these events had taken place, the attacks on.
I never saw, you know, or could join the passage of my works, you see. I don't know what happened to 10 Americans. They showed it in New York at Staten Island, and then elements went abroad, but I don't know to what countries.
So
I couldn't.
Some of what you knew about what was going on, the attacks on Americans.
We were aware of it. We were being attacked. We were being kicked around in our own country, you know, equated with a movie with hooligans on motorbikes who take over a town and rape everybody. And, you know, did you see that?
Yeah.
And we are like that. No, we weren't like that. You know, what
so
the hell is this?
It was being written in the papers then, too. Critics were attacking the work.
Oh, yeah.
So you learned about it there, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The latest, living here, I'm cut off. I've been cut off from things. But the incident of the toilet seat, you know, I told you about that.
Mm-hmm.
And the interest in it that engulfed about 13 historians who really should have been doing something, you know, spending their time in a more productive manner, you know. My daughter sent me an article from the Times, and we wrote to the fellow who wrote the article. But in New York, you were aware of these attacks. When I came to Alaska, and was able to travel freely, I'd go down to Big Sur, where I met Giles Greville Healy, who's related to Andre Monroe.
How do you spell it? Giles who?
Giles, G-I-L-E-S. Giles Greville.
G-R-E-V-I-L-L-E.
Yeah, two L's.
Two L's.
Healy, H-E-A-L-Y.
Okay.
Giles Greville Healy.
Mm-hmm.
He was also... So once again, I posed singular questions to Andre Monroe through Giles Healy. And through Giles Healy, I received a letter of introduction to Picasso, you see.
Oh,
and this is in a big Sur. I think that... I don't know what to think. I think when you are part of a movement, you know, then sort of history takes care of you, but then you still wonder why people bludgeoned you over the head, you know why that something has succeeded and it's great, but why did these people carry on this way? And one by one, I realized why. Governments were, the French made, these countries were desperate for American money, desperate for it. They had populations who were starving, you know. They needed money. Some people came along called the Beatles. All of them were presented with medals, ordered of the British Empire by the Queen. They could rightly be called Sir Beetle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They brought money to England, like $600 million a year, you see. The French had a market here that had a value of around $1.4 billion a year. And yet, going back to the turn of the century, to the exhibition in the Armory in New York, where we learned about Marcel Duchamp, you know, new descending a staircase, and the official art in this country, which you have to contend with, you know, if you do avant-garde work, had embraced the British and the German schools of art and Greek sculpture. You see a picture of, you go to the home state of Abraham Lincoln, and you'll see an official portrait of Abraham Lincoln in a Greek toga, you know. You see, all right, and so on and so forth. These were the predominant school.
Classic.
Mm-hmm. Classic, the English going back to the portraits of George Washington and what have you, all done in the British school. To the turn of the century, squabbles, in the art world, the provenance was an issue, or the aesthetics was an issue, we wind up in a British courthouse. Whistler is an American. What's he doing in a British court demanding damages for a painting that some guy said looks like hog swill, mm-hmm. you see? And he won a farthing, the lowest coin of the realm, mm-hmm. you see? But got his costs paid, you see? But they're in a British court, you see? The quality and the adjudication of a painting done within the British school would bring forth RAs, members of the Royal Academy, you see. But the art of Rothko, when you had an art dealer who had stolen all of it, his life's work, and smuggled them out of the country to take them to England, he stole the life work of the man.
After
he died, he had he set up a probate thing, and there were painters on it. Some of them I know, some of them I don't want to know. I can't think of their names. There was a Greek guy I'd exhibited with, but they were on this sort of probate board, and they had agreed to this, that the paintings belonged to the president of Marlborough Gallery in New York, a thief.
Yeah.
And the paintings were in a transshipment warehouse in Canada, ready for shipment abroad. The thing that stopped this was a lawsuit of his 17 and a half year old daughter. And she demanded that the paintings be returned, that they belonged to her. And the gallery, they became involved in a battle called the $64 million question was the title of, and she won the custody of all of the of his artworks. There were people in the art business who were trying to curry favor with Marlborough and the other galleries, and guys I'm really ashamed of that testified against this girl. She wasn't interested in painting, so why should we give her all these paintings? Blah blah blah. It's horseshit, nonsense, you know. But this is something that some decades before would have been settled in a British court. You know, with people asserting, yes, these are done within the style of the Royal Academy, you know, you see. But so these great cases take place here, because the experts are here. You know, there's some creepy guy, an action painter in the dock, you know, speaking up.
Well, also, Rothko was American, wasn't he, when he died? So, and his daughter was living here? Or?
The family came from Seattle.
I read a book by Dory Ashton about him.
Yeah.
In a thin volume. He talked about his distress over a lot of political stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, he came out of that kind of.
Right, kind yeah. Of yeah, we came.
Wasn't his family from Russia?
Originally? Yeah, they were. They were all from the same area.
Right. So, at any rate, being in the court, if I'm understanding you, her lawsuit to retain or get back possession of the paintings would take place in America.
In America, yes.
You're not talking about the court of public opinion. You're talking about
a court of law.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you think that before, I mean, in the earlier times...
If these were paintings done under the aegis or the specifications of the Royal Academy...
They would have been involved?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Even though
and an American painter named Whistler, you know.
But he lived in England all his adult life. He never came back to the U.S.
Well, that's where he made a living, but we love his paintings.
But he was an expatriate, really. I mean, he went to England.
Yeah. But, I mean, this is the most notable case, you see.
Uh-huh.
Whistler's mother, I mean, it's unbelievable that he's trying to... show this quality and provenance in the battle in the British court, you know. I can just see Jackson Pollock setting up shop in a court of law and explaining his work, you know, to Dutch people or the Germans or the British. Impossible. Well, now but in New York there'd be, you know, a support for him. You know, I can see all the experts, people with the X-rays, infrared readings, palimpsest experts, and so on and so forth. No, the total, going back to the turn of the century, all of the money that went to American artists, see, amounted to no more than just less than $100 million a year. But to the French alone, they took 10 times that, well, more than 10 times that, over $1 billion. And the British and the French, too, made lots of money here. When the American School of Painting came about, and to study the wherewithal, you couldn't study this phenomenon there, people came here to study here in the United States. It was a school. And during the boom, the sales of American painting in Manhattan alone, where there were once 12 galleries that catered to us, you see. And getting into them was very precarious, so you had to have baggage, you know. The gross sales, of the efforts of something like 1,200 men and women, exceeded $2 billion in Manhattan alone. I remember there were four print galleries, two in New York, one in Chicago, one in Los Angeles, selling prints. Now the galleries that sell prints, about 10 years ago, I think there were 36,000 that sell
prints. But you're
prints.
Talking about the mass-produced poster prints, not limited edition.
Well, we're talking about gross sales of what has become an industry.
Okay.
Compared to this. Now, the gross sales of the garment industry, which affects the attention of 440,000 people, and I've been there, I've worked there, you know. I was involved with the union, somewhat reluctantly at first, produces, its gross sales are $1.2 billion. They produce clothing right to the Middle West. They have a little bit of an argument with sportswear and coordinates with the California makers, you know. But I see they're distributing on the coast. But a handful of people, relatively speaking, have doubled their gross sales. That's what I mean, you see. And perhaps it's not apropos to talk about print galleries, you know, mass-produced prints, but that's all a spin-off.
It's still art, yeah.
It's still
right.
Art.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny,
yeah.
In art.
I mean, I wouldn't kick a Picasso print out of the house, you know. Well, it was a disaster for the French. They wanted to revive their sales here.
Mm-hmm. So they tried to politicize art trends. And
yeah, it's why Moreau was hired as a yard dog. To go into the home of Picasso in his studio, which is just outside of Valerie's, a 3-mile walk, and I'd walk there. There was a little post house next to a gate, and in that little house was a little circular table, you know, a little circular table, roughly the size, and it was piled with letters, and the letters spilled down onto the floor. So in this little house, guardhouse, or you walked over letters, you see. If the therapist, the guardian of the gate, was the Spanish poet and companion of Picasso, I've got his name written down. Jaime, something or another, not D'Angelo, another guy I met in Big Sur. And I remember my letter was just one of thousands. I remember walking through this half darkened post house. I'm tramping on letters from the Metropolitan Museum and people like that, you know.
He just left them on the floor.
Just a Jaime. That was Jaime de Sabartes, the guardian of Picasso's gates in Valerice. Jaime, J-A-I-M-E, D-D-E, Sabartes, S-A-B-A-R-T-E-S. He fled the Civil War in Spain with Picasso. The first time I saw him, it was in a barbershop in Valerice, and he had, the master had had a haircut that morning, and I missed him, but here was this little guy, and he was had a little dustpan and a brush, and he was gathering up the hair of Picasso and putting it in a plastic bag. And then they ran a vacuum cleaner over this. And he said, the barber said he always does that because of the evil eye. Someone might get hold of one of Pablo's hairs and make his life miserable or even kill him.
How do you spell Valerice?
V-A-L-L-A-U-R-I-S.
Okay.
I think I told you about that, the incident there at the home of Picasso.
You may have, but
yeah, I think I did. I went there on some successive days, and I leave the house where I lived at dawn in Valerice and would walk to the Via California, the Villa California. Oh, pretty little bird out there. Good God. Oh, it's just a sparrow, I guess. Look at that. You see that? Look at its stripes. Is that a red head?
It looks like one of those red...
Red poles, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, back to the, where was I?
Well, you'd leave your place and go to the village.
Yeah. The first time I went there, there were people picketing his house. These were German artists or students. And I kind of remonstrated with them and then had to walk back to Valerice. The next time I went there, there were huge black limousines and people with guns, with automatic weapons, French police, and Russian police officers, which seemed strange. Russian bodyguards who were armed, which is kind of unusual. You know, they were not in Russia, but... And so I was told to get away from the house and troop back to Valerie's. And I went there the following day. And it was quiet. And I banged on the little gatehouse door. And this slot opened. And these crazy eyes of Jaime de Sabartes looked out. He says, "What do you want?" I said, "I want to see the master. And I've come a long way." He said, "Well, he's a busy man." I said, "Look, I was in Rome 3 weeks ago and I had an audience with the Pope." He said, "Well, that's his job. It's not Picasso's job to leave his work." And he closed the slot and I banged again. I thought, well, I've walked 24 miles now there and back. So I muttered some obscenities and turned about. Began walking away from the house. And a man was hollering, shouting at me, and it was Jaime. And he said, have you pissed? And I thought, I didn't know what to say. I thought, you know, in God's name, or maybe I don't speak the language or something. And I said, no. He said, well, then come here. And he had a Spanish gourd, you know, a little wine thing. He said, here, drink this, drink all of it, follow me. And I followed him into this little house. And it was this table with this mound of letters. Walking over letters, you know, God, if only. And we come out into the courtyard, and there was the maestro, and he was doing something very ancient, very time honored. He was introducing, he was doing a series of sculpture called L'Homme, Le Mouton, man and, you know, a shepherd with a lamb, man with a lamb. And he had just received a shipment of one of these, and he was urinating over it. Now, when you get the thing straight from the forge, straight from the casting, urine is really a good patina.
On bronze?
On brass or bronze or whatever it was. So I was directed to piss over the lamb, actually. And but this was rudely disturbed by Jacqueline Gillot, and who was in a jeep with four children. And I did feel embarrassed. I thought, my God, what are children doing here? Why is this woman shouting at me? She's insisting that I leave. And Jaime says, you better go now, and thank you. And so I went back to Valerie's. That was very hurtful. But many years later, when Lady Bullitt and Edwin, Sir Edwin, came here to conduct a seminar at the Geophysical Institute, she had two girlfriends. One was Jacqueline Gillot, and one was the wife of the author of The Ascent of Man. And I knew both of these ladies. Well, I can't say I know Jacqueline Gillot, except she told me to get the hell out. But I know the other lady as someone who came from my district, a Luntzman from Lithuania to Bo. And she said, I want you to talk to these ladies and tell them to come up here. Tell them how nice the weather is. You know, it was June up here, beautiful. And they put me on the phone. I thought, Jacqueline, this is where you get it. I said, how do you feel about when you ran me off out of Villa, California? And I was doing what is a traditional thing for a sculptor, directed to do this by the maestro. And she said, I'm very sorry. I won't do it again. But now she's married to Dr. This guy who invented the polio vaccine, Jonas Salk. She's now Mrs. Jonas Salk. And the other lady who I remember is Sandra, said, I can't come, Alfred. She says, I remember you. I can't come because my daughter's getting married tomorrow in Phoenix and I have to be there. Believe me. I said, I believe you. So that was the last, that story played out up here under the aegis of Lady Bullard. And it's, you know, I think that Bullard, when I was, seemed a very childlike man, you know.
And, you said you are
he. I was introduced to him in the penthouse of the Geophysical.
Lord Bullard?
Sir Edwin.
Sir Bullard. Edwin, okay.
And he, of course, gave us, I think, he's a Nobel laureate for tectonic plates and earthquakes, you see. And whilst I was there at this lunch, we had sort of a hot table set up. Dr. Keenley and Turner were there, the late Dr. Keenley. And there was an earthquake. And I remember Turner and Keenly falling to their knees and doing calculations with slipsticks and slide rules and stuff like that. They placed the location of the earthquake. I said, it's Badger Road. And it was 3 point, and this was the first earthquake that Sir Edwin had ever experienced in his life. He's an expert on earthquakes. And he was so happy, you know. So damn happy. I just ate my English muffins and stuff and thought I'd leave well enough alone and get the hell out of there. He was in for 1 year, and Lady Ursula did some sketches about Cash. She's the lady who went to the old artworks when it was on College Road. I said, I've seen this work before, and she had, at the Whitechapel Gallery in London. She went there to...
Was it your work?
Yeah, I was as a student. Well, I did so much when I was just a goddamn student,
yeah,
you know.
And you still had some of it, and you put it in the artwork?
No, I did work, fresh work. It was on the wall, and
she
saw, yeah, the style, you know. And so I enrolled her in the Herod sketch group, which has been going on for years. And then they came back the following year. His talks were very popular, and they came back again. Yeah. She died, I think he died. Everyone's dying. Grief. We often think of Picasso as sort of a doctrinaire communist, you know. Of course, he supported Soviet policies and this ideological aggression that, you know, we've been witness to. But when the actor Gary Cooper visited him, Gary Cooper received an award at the Cannes Film Festival for High Noon. He took his six gun to Picasso, and he wanted a painting in exchange for the gun he wore in High Noon. To everyone's amazement, Picasso almost went bananas and threw him out. He said, I don't want your gun. You are imperialists who stole the soil of Spain. And he said, California belongs to the people of Spain. And this Villa California, you illiterate, means Villa California! And he ran his ass out of there. I got a better welcome than that, you know, with all the misunderstandings. I often think about that. That's sort of an antediluvian historical thing, you know. How can you believe in empires that California belongs to you and yet be a communist, you know?
Right, yeah. He apparently didn't worry about contradictions all that much, did he?
No. No, I don't think so. And yet the evil eye, you know, he's worried about that. His hair, every hair would be picked up by Jaime. Very, very real fear that he had of the evil eye. Well,
how are we doing here? We got...
I don't know.
We're pretty close to the end. Are you feeling a little...
Yeah, I'm feeling a little...
Tapering off? Okay.
Do you have a question, you know?
Well... None in particular right now. I'm getting kind of a sense of something about your life is coming together in my mind in a way. It's becoming sort of bounded, which is really good.
Yeah.
So I feel more like some of these stories, I have places for them in my mind,
yeah.
How things fit together, and that I think it's important right now to keep your way of telling stories, your words, in other words, just as they are.
Okay.
If I ask a question on here that it needs to be in there, I'll type that in too.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I won't. I don't need necessity for it.
Okay.
And at some point, we'll start cutting and pasting, probably to try to get stories that belong together, pieces of them.
Yeah.
In one.
You know, yeah. That you have to teach me.
Yeah.
I don't know how to.
Guys, I got a cramp in my leg and I've got to get up.
Well, okay. You have to, let's just.